Sure, I'm sorry about that. I will just say that I'm very optimistic about the fight, and I think we're going to win. I'll leave it there.
Ta-Nehisi Coates, acclaimed writer, National Book Award winner, spoke at an event last night organized by Palestine Festival of Literature here in New York. We will link to the live stream. Before we end this update from Gaza, the Palestinian Wafa News Agency is reporting at least 27 people were killed today in an Israeli bombing of an UNRWA school in the Jabalia refugee camp, the largest refugee camp in Gaza. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
KBOO Portland.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a new report shows the Keller Auditorium is at risk in the case of a major earthquake in Portland. Portland teachers are on strike, at least through the weekend.
It does not help retain quality educators and diverse educators when they can't afford to live in the city.
And how a new crackdown is impacting renters with emotional support animals. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, November 2nd, 2023. I'm Annette Newell. Thanks so much for joining us tonight. A strong earthquake could completely destroy the Keller Auditorium, according to a new seismic report released to the city of Portland. KBOO's Josh Salem has more on the story.
A seismic report delayed by the COVID pandemic suggests the Keller Auditorium could be seriously damaged or even destroyed in the event of an earthquake. The city of Portland is trying to figure out what to do with that information. The Keller Auditorium has been a home for a number of artistic performances since 1917. In the 1960s, the city renovated Keller to meet safety standards of the time. Standards have since evolved and now include earthquake precautions. Major earthquakes are expected in the area every 250 to 500 years. The last big earthquake struck the Pacific Northwest in 1700, 323 years ago. Keller is considered an unreinforced masonry building. There are currently 1,600 unreinforced masonry buildings in Portland alone. Last year, Portland city leaders reached out to local contractors to identify the best plans to improve Keller. 8 proposals were submitted. Many changes are needed in addition to the seismic upgrade. These include things like ADA accessibility, putting in a kitchen, and expanding the loading dock. One estimate for a top-to-bottom renovation of Keller said the project would last roughly 28 months and cost about $236 million. One of the biggest concerns many people have is where to hold shows during construction. At present, there aren't any other suitable venues capable of housing large performances on such a grand scale. Thus, there might not be any scheduled shows or revenue for at least 2 years. The city is also reviewing the option of building a brand new Keller Auditorium at a different location. That cost would be around $300 million, but it would allow use of the current facility during construction. Ashley Stragg is an associate professor of geology at Portland State University who specializes in earthquake geology. She said, quote, "I'm not willing to walk into the Keller Auditorium with my child and watch a show because I understand what's going to happen to that structure, but that's an individual assessment," end quote. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
For a second day, 81 schools in Oregon's largest district are closed. More than 4,000 teachers are on strike, and about 45,000 children are not in classes. It's the first time in the district's history that teachers have gone on strike. Angela Bonilla is a teacher and the president of the union, the Portland Association of Teachers. She released a statement about why this is happening.
My name is Angela Bonilla. I am the current PAT president, a fourth grade Spanish immersion teacher in an elementary school in Northeast Portland. Right behind me, we have a parachute, and the parachute says, "Our schools power our communities." I feel like that slogan is really important to us because our schools are the hearts of our community. We know that when folks need something, they usually go to their public school, to their teacher. As educators, we often hear first from families and communities when there are needs. And so we are the first line of support in our neighborhoods. And we want to make sure that our schools actually serve those communities, that we have community schools where our students and our families and our community partners have shared governance, because we are the ones who see our families and our students and our communities every single day for several hours a day and want to ensure that they have what they need to thrive. Our schools power our communities because our schools are a reflection of our communities. We are trying to build a vision for the future. We're trying to see something that we've been told is impossible every year, that we could have great public schools for all Portland students, that we can have enough time to actually teach kids what they need to learn, that we have enough support so that they feel seen, like they belong. And that type of vision needs art. We have to be able to come together and build something beautiful and say, oh yeah, I can see that happening. I can see how our schools power our communities. I can see what solidarity looks like on the ground in real time. So I think art is just so, so important for the human condition in general, but especially when we're trying to build something new, because it helps build that inspiration for all of us that it's possible. Our class sizes in Portland are ballooning and have been ballooning for several years, while the district has continued to cut classified and certified educators, people who directly serve students, and increase administrative positions. So we have been asking for class size caps, especially in our Title I schools, and are requesting that they do that for all schools. And we are also asking for workload relief, so enough planning time to support excessively large classes so that every kid gets the attention and feedback they deserve so that they can grow and learn. We know Portland is one of the most expensive cities to live in. In fact, it's the second most expensive city to be a first-year teacher.
And that was Angela Bonilla. She's an elementary school teacher in Northeast Portland who is the president of the Portland Association of Teachers, whose strike is expected to last through at least this weekend. Leaders of Oregon's largest school district are also speaking out, including Portland Public Schools Superintendent Guadalupe Guerrero. Here's what he said at a press conference about the strike.
Here at PPS, as we begin this morning, I want to make sure and center us on the most important aspect of our work, and that's our children. The core mission of any school system is to educate its children and its youth, to make sure that our students have an excellent school experience every single day. We know that the work of teaching and learning is only possible because of our incredibly talented professional educators and support staff. I recognize the undeniable fact that our educators' work has shifted and changed. As educators, we know our students now need more support than ever to address pandemic learning loss and mental health. And pro-social interactions with trusted and adults and peers is important. These needs have required us to shift how we educate and serve our students. As a district, 90% of our dollars are being invested and spent in our schools. We continue to use all of our resources, from the federal COVID relief to the Student Success Act, to provide more services like tutoring, summer school, counselors, social workers, reading specialists, and so much more. And as state assessments indicated a few weeks ago, we're one of the few districts in Oregon where students are beginning to show signs of recovery. And we still have more work to do there. But the reality is, to sustain these investments, we need real investment from the state. Since 2020, PPS's revenue has increased by 9%, but against 18% of inflation. This funding has not kept pace with the needs of our students, nor our educators. Nor does it invest in K-12 schools at the level recommended by the state's own quality educational model. Let's sit with that for a moment. The state of Oregon is not funding what they themselves have identified as a quality education for Oregon students. And here we are, at the district level, wanting to pay our educators a quality education salary and give our students a quality educational experience, but without a quality education level of funding. Despite this, we strive to offer a compensation that attracts and retains talent. This is a basic principle of a strong organization. private or public. We want people to work for us. But unlike a private organization, we don't have record profits we can tap into. And I also want to dwell on this point, because some folks are inclined to compare this strike to the auto workers or the screenwriters and actors. Folks, we're not funded in the same way. No one gets multi-million dollar stock options from a school district. There's no record profits. All we have is inadequate funding from the state while working to produce improved outcomes and opportunities for our students. It is within this context and these constraints that we have worked for over 10 months to be responsive to the expressed concerns of our teachers. But we're not prepared to accept $370 million of more new spending and the hundreds of millions of dollars in cuts it would require. Those cuts are less employees potentially. Those cuts would mean higher class sizes potentially. Those cuts could mean reduced services to our students. We have an obligation to operate a fiscally responsible organization. And the union's proposal, which remains largely unchanged after 10 months of negotiations, is not fiscally responsible. It's challenging to hear the union call for increased student supports while standing in an uncompromising fashion on a package that would require cuts to the very supports that we have already put in place and made deep investments in. It's challenging to hear the union call for lower class sizes while continuing to advance a compensation package that would require us to cut teachers, thus making it impossible to meet class size mandates that they propose. Independent economists agree that their proposal will require the equivalent of at least 288 teachers from schools. We're eager to work with our educators to find a solution within our fixed revenue and our operational limitations, but we're unable to meet core demands. That remains the case, strike or no strike.
And that's Portland Public Schools Superintendent Guadalupe Guerrero commenting on the first ever teacher strike in Oregon's largest school district. Some lawmakers are challenging his statements about the state not adequately funding education. Increased renter restrictions are targeting emotional support animals with a new law in Montana. As Mark Moran reports, renters will have to provide medical evidence that they need the animals before they can sign a lease.
Fair housing advocates are concerned about changes the legislature made to tighten restrictions on emotional support animals for Montana renters. While Montana House Bill 703 prohibits a landlord from asking detailed questions about a potential renter's medical conditions or diagnosis, landlords are now allowed to ask the renter's health care provider if the emotional support animal is medically necessary before deciding whether to rent to that tenant. Amy Hall with Montana Fair Housing says the law creates potential roadblocks for would-be tenants, because it requires them to have a relationship with a Montana healthcare provider for at least a month before being able to provide verification to the landlord.
Sometimes that can pose a hardship for tenants because they may not have lived in Montana for 30 days and they may not have established a relationship with a provider here.
The law also holds tenants liable for damages the emotional support animal may do to the landlord's property. HB 703 only applies to emotional support animals. It doesn't apply to service animals such as seeing eye dogs that have special training to help people with disabilities perform everyday tasks. Hall adds that federal law still applies in Montana, which says the verification of the need for an emotional support animal does not always have to come from a certified medical professional in order for the applicant to get a lease. She adds, however, that it will take something more official than an online document, which had become popular in recent years, to verify that the animal is medically and emotionally necessary for the renter.
That's just a warning to all tenants out there. If your only verification that you need an emotional support animal is that you have some kind of online certificate, your landlord may question that and may ask for sufficient verification of your need for the emotional support animal and of your disability.
The new law went into effect October 1st. This is Mark Moran.
Continued food waste in the U.S. is alarming states with high food scarcity. Roz Brown reports.
A new government report highlights the urgent need to keep food out of landfills, noting that 30-40% of food produced in the U.S. is never eaten. The percentage of food waste is especially alarming for states with the highest rates of food scarcity, such as New Mexico. Nina Sevilla with the nonprofit environmental advocacy group Natural Resources Defense Council says despite federal goals to reduce food waste, too much is still ending up in landfills or incinerators.
And when we waste that food, we waste all the resources that went into producing the food, processing, packaging, cooling, transporting, and then ultimately transporting it to the landfill as well.
The Environmental Protection Agency released a second report quantifying methane emissions, noting that the breakdown of wasted food is a major issue because methane is responsible for about a quarter of global warming. The agency found that even though total emissions from municipal solid waste decreased from 1990 to 2020, methane emissions from landfill food waste are increasing. Researchers say households are responsible for at least 40% of food waste in the U.S., and changing that would require both psychological and lifestyle changes. Sevilla notes the problem is greater than consumers tossing food into their kitchen garbage.
It also represents about 16% of all the cropland that's used to grow food. So 16% of that land is used to grow food that ultimately ends up in the landfill.
The EPA also released an update to its food recovery hierarchy, a tool to help decision makers, such as state and local governments, understand the best options for managing food waste in terms of environmental impacts. This is Roz Brown.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for KBOO News in Depth. We'll have the Global Citizen International commentary and then an interview with the organizer of the Legendary Makers Market, an Asian American night maker in Portland. Then at 6 o'clock, it's Rose City Native Radio. And at 7, American Indian Airwaves. Tonight's weather, considerable cloudiness and a slight chance of rain, a low down to 51. Tomorrow's weather, clouds continue with rain showers in the afternoon, a high of 63. Today in history, on this date in 1983, President Ronald Reagan signed a bill designating a federal holiday, honoring Martin Luther King Jr. to be observed on the third Monday of January. Our quote of the day is from MLK Jr. We must accept finite disappointment, but never lose infinite hope. Muslim American leaders in the U.S. are denouncing a rise in anti-Semitism and Islamophobia. The House Republican aid proposal for Israel could add billions to the national debt. And Congressman Ken Buck of Colorado says GOP election denialism has prompted him to leave Congress. With more on the stories impacting our democracy, here's 2023 Talks.
Welcome to 2023 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
Trucks at Harvard University driving around with faces and names of students who had signed on to pro-Palestinian statements. Corporations saying things like, give us the names of students who have spoken out and we won't hire them.
Corey Saylor with the Council on American Islamic Relations says common anti-Muslim tropes are showing up again. CARE says President Joe Biden's questioning of Palestinian casualty numbers and law enforcement's warnings about possible Islamic terrorist attacks echo stereotypes of violent and dishonest Arabs. The group says a ceasefire would cool anti-Jewish and anti-Muslim tensions here. The White House is developing a first national strategy on Islamophobia as polls show Biden's support among Arab Americans has plummeted. In response to heckling from a rabbi calling for a ceasefire, Biden Wednesday restated his support for the two-state solution and a humanitarian pause. A House plan for Israeli aid is hitting resistance. Without funds for Ukraine, it's a non-starter in the Senate, and Biden has promised to veto it. House Speaker Mike Johnson tells Fox News any Israel aid must stand alone, and he's calling for cuts to the IRS to pay for it.
I think if you put this to the American people and they weigh the two needs, I think they're going to say standing with Israel and protecting the innocent over there is in our national interest and is a more immediate need than IRS agents.
The Congressional Budget Office reports those cuts could cost billions in lost tax revenue, adding $25 billion to the deficit over a decade. Republican Congressman Ken Buck of Colorado says he won't seek re-election. Buck tells MSNBC he's disappointed in his party's continued election denialism and support for January 6th rioters.
If we're going to solve difficult problems, we've got to deal with some very unpleasant truths or lies and make sure that we project to the public what the truth is.
Buck was one of just two House Freedom Caucus members who voted to certify Biden's 2020 win. Republican House Appropriations Chair Kay Granger of Texas also just announced she won't run again. Former President Donald Trump is asking a Michigan court to stop a lawsuit that would block him from the ballot. Suits in three states point to the Civil War era 14th Amendment as barring insurrectionists from office. Trump says Secretary of State Jocelyn Benson lacks the authority to enforce the amendment, but Benson says that's up to the Supreme Court.
There's a lot of evidence in the public record and in several indictments to suggest interference with the effort to overturn the will of the people.
Public school teachers and staff in Portland, Oregon are on strike for the first time in the city's history. They say students are struggling with large class sizes and limited mental health resources. Angela Bonilla with the Portland Association of Teachers also cites low pay.
It does not help retain quality educators and diverse educators when they can't afford to live in the city.
The district's new teacher-based salary starts at $50,000, lending many to quit in the first 5 years. I'm Farah Siddiqui for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
Two recent federal packages of lots of money are spurring infrastructure projects around the U.S., including water system improvements and broadband access. Mike Moen has more in the story.
President Joe Biden was in southern Minnesota yesterday to highlight federal investments for rural America. Biden visited a farm near Northfield to discuss funding from recent packages such as the Bipartisan Infrastructure Law and the Inflation Reduction Act, with the latter focusing on climate projects and healthcare assistance. For agriculture, the administration says there's new funding for farmers to take advantage of climate-friendly practices such as nutrient management, with other provisions designed to create market fairness. Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack spoke at the event and says these efforts allow rural residents to try and keep their communities vibrant.
They want their families to have the opportunity to farm and to work and to raise their families in the small communities where they come from.
And while the infrastructure law receives support from lawmakers on both sides, Republicans strongly oppose the Inflation Reduction Act. They've been trying to cut some elements of the law amid budget battles in Congress. Some of the proposed rollbacks would come under the Farm Bill reauthorization, with opponents of such moves arguing there would be a negative impact on rural communities. Meanwhile, there's $65 billion within the infrastructure law to boost access to high-speed internet, with the hopes of enhancing efforts to close broadband gaps in rural areas. Josh Sumption is with an education service agency for the southwest and west central parts of the state. He says they welcome any help in putting local students in a better position to learn in the digital age.
For schools, it's really about students being able to continue to learn and take their homework home and stay connected to their educational institutions and the resources that they're using in the classroom.
Like other voices in education, he says the pandemic made worse some of the internet connection challenges rural students face. Sumption acknowledges recent federal investments might not close all broadband gaps, but he says he's hopeful that more projects will be shovel-ready very soon, citing additional funding from the state. This is Mike Moen.
The feds are spending $327 million to create reliable water supplies for some tribes in the West. The wholesaler Cost Savers in Kodiak is now under new ownership. And a leading lawyers group hosts a Native Women's Trailblazers event. With these stories and more, here's National Native News.
The federal government is spending another $327 million to help fulfill water rights settlements with tribes across the West. The Mountain West News Bureau's Caleb Bradle reports.
The money will be used on projects to create reliable water supplies for tribes. Nearly $70 million is going to the pueblos of Nambe, Powake, San Ildefonso, and Tasuki in New Mexico. More than $6 million is going to the Nez Perce tribe in Idaho. Roughly half that will go to the Southern Ute tribe in Colorado. More than $160 million will fund a pipeline project that would deliver water to dozens of Navajo chapters, as well as the Tepe Junction area of the Jicarilla Apache Nation and the city of Gallup, New Mexico. Here's Navajo Nation President Boo Nigrin speaking before the Senate Indian Affairs Committee earlier this year.
About 30% of the Navajo households continue to lack running water. They rely on hauling water to meet their daily needs. This region has long suffered from limited access to clean and reliable water.
He says the completion of the pipeline would provide just that to 250,000 people. For National Native News, I'm Caleb Radel.
In Alaska, Kodiak's wholesale store Cost Savers is now under tribal ownership. People should expect business as usual, but as KMXT's Brian Venwell reports, it's the latest move in improving food security on the island.
The native village of Afognak is the new majority owner of the store, which will still be called Cost Savers. They've partnered with the Shunack tribe of Kodiak for the purchase. J.J. Marsh is the tribal administrator for the Shunack tribe.
I just think it's a great partnership. You know, it's time for our tribes to collaborate and work together.
And Candace Branson is the tribal administrator for the native village of Afognak. She says they initially wanted to buy just an empty lot near the store to expand the village's farm programs, but ended up buying the store as well.
After some contemplation and looking at the financials and thinking about the impact that it would have to run our own grocery operation like that, and the impact on food security that it could have and on helping our bottom line.
Branson says for now, staff are looking at filling open positions and overall maintaining the status quo.
We are looking at just stabilization for the next year and a half, 2 years, and then we'll start on the development.
Marsh says this is the Shunack tribe's latest step in diversifying its investment portfolio.
We are trying to find ways to sustain our tribes in the future, especially with food security and putting our people to work also.
But buying Cost Savers isn't the only part of a new joint business venture. The native village of Afognak co-operates Malik Farms, which is one of six tribally owned farms on the island. Branson says they hope to have locally grown produce on shelves in the next few years. The Shunack tribe also owns Kodiak Island Wild Source, a seafood processing business. Marsh says it's too early in the process to sell its products in the store, but patrons could see local seafood in freezers there in the next 6 months. In Kodiak, I'm Brian Benoit.
The American Bar Association is recognizing Native American Heritage Month with a presentation Thursday from Native women trailblazers. The speakers include U.S. Interior Secretary Deb Haaland, as well as Valerie Davidson, former Alaska Lieutenant Governor and current head of the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium. The other panelists include Abby Abenanti, Kim Teehee, and Stacy Leeds. Abenanti is a Yurok tribal judge and the first California tribal woman to be admitted to the California State Bar. Teehee is Director of Government Relations for the Cherokee Nation and served as the first senior policy advisor for Native American Affairs in the White House. Leeds is an Indigenous law and policy scholar and the first Indigenous woman to serve as a law school dean. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Wolverines could get federal protection starting this month under the Endangered Species Act. Eric Galatis reports the animals are losing habitat in western states due to human activities and climate change.
Wyoming's elusive population of wolverines, whose contributions include keeping in check squirrel and other small mammal populations living at high elevations and deep snowpack, are at risk due to loss of habitat and climate change. The latest U.S. Fish and Wildlife Species Assessment also suggests that federal protections under the Endangered Species Act could come as soon as November, a move that would be welcomed by Andrea Zaccardi with the Center for Biological Diversity.
Believed that the Fish Wildlife Service finally recognized the threats to wolverines, and we're hopeful that that will lead to a decision to federally protect them in the future.
Wolverines in the lower 48 were driven to the brink of extinction due to fur trapping and poisoning, but reemerged after states added protections. Wyoming prohibits hunting or trapping wolverines, but has opposed federal protections. Former Governor Matt Mead told Fish and Wildlife that members of the Wolverine Science Panel were uncertain about climate changes impacts on wildlife. Zaccardi notes whatever skepticism that may have existed over the impact of climate change on wolverines is not represented in Fish and Wildlife's new report.
The new assessment shows that there is consensus among scientists as to the threats that wolverines are facing and that climate change is a real threat to these species.
Conservationists say protecting wolverines alongside grizzlies, lynx, wolves, and other species at risk safeguards Wyoming's wild spaces that are central to the state's identity and draw visitors from across the globe. Zaccardi believes Endangered Species Act protections are a critical tool for keeping ecosystems that humans also depend on healthy and intact.
The loss of wolverines could have a profound impact on the general health of ecosystems across the Mountain West that they inhabit.
This is Eric Galatis.
You're listening to the KVOO Evening News for Thursday, November 2nd, 2023. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. You can call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem, Mel Gertov, Andrea K. Hendrickson, Mike Moen, Mark Moran, Roz Brown, and Eric Galatis. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service and Native Voice One. Our director of evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell. So glad to have you with us. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News In-Depth. Coming up next, we'll have the Global Citizen International Commentary and an interview with the organizer of the legendary Maker's Market, an Asian American night maker in Portland. That's up next.
Welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest with Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. It's critical commentary on foreign affairs from a human interest perspective. The opinions expressed in the following segment are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest. I'm Mel Gertov, and I'll be reporting and commenting on the most important and sometimes the most neglected international news of the past week or so. Here are some of the news items I'll be covering. Close encounters require U.S.-China military talks. Dividing Gaza, an Israeli strategy. And a congressional commission advocates more nuclear weapons. Close encounters between the U.S. and China. U.S. officials have announced that the president will meet Xi Jinping in San Francisco later this month.